49 people on here.
Good evening. I'd like to call this session of the Legislative Energy Commission to order. Thank you for joining us on a Thursday night, so close to the holidays. We have a couple of introductory and administrative items at the outset. We have hired an executive director for the Legislative Energy Commission, and for folks who have not met her, she's Annie Levinson-Falk, and we are really pleased to have her. Did you have a few words you wanted to say?
Just that I'm very excited to be here. I know I have a lot to learn from all of you, and I'm looking forward to working with all of you as we go.
So hopefully Annie will help us tackle some big issues. We have some minutes. Representative Falk.
Just to clarify, there's no relation. I know it's kind of an uncommon last name, but no relation, so.
Thanks for pointing that out. We have some minutes from June 20th and September 25th. Representative Marty, did you want to move adoption of those minutes?
Yes, I will. Are they in effect? I move the adoption of the minutes.
In our first act of faith in our new executive director, all those in favor of approval of the minutes, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, please say no. The motion prevails. The minutes are approved. There's a proposed rule change. My understanding is that there are other commissions in the legislative under the auspices of the Legislative Coordinating Commission where the executive director is able to approve expenses so that every time the executive director incurs a parking expense or something like that, that the co-chairs don't need to sign off on that. And the proposal in front of the commission tonight is to change the rules. We don't have a quorum, so actually I should I don't think we have a quorum. No. So we should hold off on that, and members can take a look at that. We'll get to it later. With regard to the next meeting dates and times, we surveyed the members of the commission about when they would prefer to meet. It's my understanding that it was about 50-50 on days and evenings. A lot of legislators work in the off-season at another job, and yet there are some people who travel from out of town, and for those people, days would be easier. So what we decided to do was alternate. And the next meeting we're planning to have on January 8th will be a daytime meeting. And in all likelihood, the one on February 12th would be an evening meeting, but that's not for sure. We can do a little rock, paper, scissors on that, and maybe the 12th would be daytime. But for sure, January 8th, we're planning for daytime. I think with that, you know, at the last couple of meetings we had, we talked about the responsibilities of the Legislative Energy Commission, and I think since we have such a small group of members here right now, we'll skip over that, and we will start with our agenda. Tonight, we're going to take a deeper look at some of the issues in energy efficiency. In the next session, it's going to be a very short session, 8 to 10 weeks, and the only things that we'll be able to move forward successfully through the session are things that have broad support across a lot of interest. And so we're taking a look at the area of energy efficiency to see what those topics are where we might have some common ground between utilities and environmental interests, Republicans and Democrats. And first up, we're going to hear from Bill Grant on Minnesota's existing energy efficiency policies and programs. So we know where we are so we can figure out where we're going. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Commission members. Bill Grant for the Department of Commerce. And what we were asked to do and what I hope we can do is provide you an overview of energy efficiency programs here in the state of Minnesota, at least those that the Department of Commerce has some responsibility for. That clearly won't cover everything that's going on in the realm of energy efficiency, but it should give you a good perspective, at least on where the state of Minnesota's, for the most part, legislatively directed program areas are. We've had a strong history of commitment to energy efficiency in Minnesota, and something that the state has been frequently recognized for. This really dates back even into the 1980s when we were one of the first states in the country to develop programs in cooperation with our utility companies to provide energy efficiency programs and services to their customers. Over that time, there have been, as you know, evolving regulations and programs, lots of stakeholder partnerships, and I think achievement of some real results, which we hope to share with you. So I want to cover the following things. The largest investment we make by some degree is in our conservation improvement program, and these are the utility-sponsored energy efficiency programs. We also, though, run a low-income weatherization program that's a federally directed program, but that the state has and local agencies have a significant role in implementing. We've been active in the area of energy codes and standards in Minnesota. We have rather robust benchmarking programs in place for monitoring the savings that we're achieving. We're a member of the federal government's Better Buildings Challenge, and I'll describe more about that. And we have a fair amount of involvement in financing programs for efficiency in the state. As I think most of you know, the legislature has spoken consistently and persuasively that energy savings are an energy resource, and by that we mean that we look at it the same way as we will any sort of supply-side resource that could also be used to serve customers. I think it was Amory Lovins that coined the term negawatts for energy efficiency programs that can be thought of in the same way as a megawatt of electricity or other energy unit. And further, that cost-effective energy savings are preferred over all other energy resources. And I think that the reason for that is both a sense that conservation of our natural resources just makes sense on a number of levels, but also a recognition that historically and still today, energy efficiency is by far and away our most cost-effective energy resource. The Conservation Improvement Program, as I mentioned, has had a pretty long history dating all the way back to 1980 when the Public Utilities Commission implemented the first pilot program to develop to demonstrate the feasibility of investments in energy efficiency. In 83, utilities with revenues over $50 million were required to operate at least one program. That was extended to all public utilities, in other words, the investor-owned utilities in 1989. 1991 required a specific level of spending by electric and natural gas utilities, and at that point, municipal and cooperative utilities were also brought into the party. 1994 was significant with respect to our relationship with Xcel Energy, at that time, of course, Northern States Power, because as a result, at least one of the results of the Prairie Island legislation, their spending level was increased above that which other utilities were required to meet. 2007, of course, was the Next Generation Energy Act. I'm going to be talking a little bit more about that, and the 1.5% savings goal that originated with the Next Generation Act went formally into effect in 2010. The thing that was really most significant, and there were a lot of significant things, obviously, with the Next Gen Act, but clearly the most important of those from the perspective of our energy efficiency efforts was converting SIP from a spending goal to a savings goal. And if you think about it, this makes a lot of sense. As regulators, we were spending a lot of time kind of bean counting to make sure that the utilities were spending at least the amount that they were required to spend. And the amount of savings they were achieving was something of an afterthought. Putting the savings goal first really sharpened the focus of our utilities on what the real goal of the Conservation Improvement Program was from the beginning. And also resulted, given where the goal was set, in significantly higher spending than had been occurring prior to that in order that the goals could be achieved. So just some social math for you on what the net result of all of these efforts has been, at least just in the last couple of years since the higher savings goal went into effect. We've saved enough energy to heat, cool, and power 102,000 homes annually on average. It's another way of saying that 2 million tons of carbon dioxide emissions were avoided from both electric and natural gas savings. It's about enough to take 370,000 cars off the road for a year. So these are not insignificant savings. And, of course, there's kind of a triple bottom line with these programs. It's not only the energy being saved by customers, it's the actual dollars in their pocket savings that they're seeing as a result of that. Particularly on the electric utility side, it also is the deferral of investments in new plant and equipment that saves not only those customers that participate in the programs, but also those non-participants. And, of course, finally, the energy that didn't have to be generated either from a fossil fuel-fired power plant or a nuclear power plant avoids that much emissions on the one hand or nuclear waste on the other. So there are a number of advantages that are achieved with these programs. Some examples of the kinds of programs that are out there for people who aren't familiar. Probably the most common are rebates for more efficient equipment. Thousands of Minnesotans have received rebates for more efficient appliances, furnaces, what have you. We also have custom rebates. These are typically for larger customers who have specific process needs for energy where the utility can help them design an energy savings retrofit and provide a rebate based on the savings that are achieved. There are a number of kind of indirect programs that utilities run as well. Education and awareness programs are common. One of the more recent innovations is in the area of behavior change programs, and perhaps some of you already receive somewhat regular mailings from your utility indicating how your energy use is doing compared with your neighbors. And what we find with those programs is that those who are doing better than their neighbors conserve more because they feel so good about the fact that they're doing such a good job. And clearly those who are doing worse than their average neighbor feel a little bit of compunction about that and actually do make investments and also change their own behavior in terms of keeping the thermostat set low during the day when they're not away, when they're not at home, turning the lights off. I mean, just the simple things that, with an occasional reminder, become more regular behavior. We're not sure with those programs what the persistence of those savings is over time, and that's one of the areas that we're currently studying to see how big of a role those programs should play in our overall effort. Turning away from the Conservation Improvement Program, which, as I say, is by far and away our largest investment here in Minnesota in these programs, in efficiency programs. The Weatherization Assistance Program is a federally funded program through the Department of Energy. Before the Stimulus Act, we were averaging 3,000 to 4,000 homes a year being weatherized. Now, or during ERA, that number jumped to 20,000 over 3 years with an expenditure of about $136 million. These programs typically involve air sealing, insulation, furnace repair and replacement, and families who receive the services of the weatherization program are typically saving somewhere between 30% and 40% on their energy bills. And this is these are savings not just for 1 year, but for typically from 15 to 20 years. It provides a number of good-paying jobs throughout the state, and our estimate is that 150,000 Minnesotans are eligible each year, but of course we're only able to serve a small fraction of those, and the federal funding for this program has been in decline for a number of years after the ERA funds were exhausted, and we do have a concern about the program's funding stability going forward. In the area of energy codes, should probably have someone here from the Department of Labor and Industry because they're really the ones that administer the building code. But our responsibility to the Department of Commerce is to assist DALI with the energy aspects of the code. The Minnesota's code was first adopted in 1976 for residential, commercial, and institutional buildings. It applies to heating, ventilating, air conditioning, and lighting. As a result of the energy code improvements that we have continually made over time, current buildings are clearly more efficient than they were in 1976 by a factor of 30%. The amendments that were made to the building code and adopted through rulemaking just are about to be adopted through rulemaking next year will make those same homes 50% better, and the same is true on the commercial side. I often get asked whether Minnesota has the strongest energy code in the country, and I think by law we're required to have the strongest energy code in the country, and obviously over time, other states kind of leapfrog our current rules, and that necessitates a rulemaking on our side. But certainly by comparison to most states, we have one of the strongest codes in the country. I'll turn next to our efforts on benchmarking of buildings. The B3 program is a tool that's designed to help make buildings more energy efficient and sustainable, and any buildings that are receiving state funding of any kind are required to benchmark their buildings in the B3 program. The tools include guidelines to make new buildings sustainable and use less energy, and the benchmarking tool is to track and monitor those energy savings over time, and frankly, to make sure that the investments that we're making in those buildings are being sustained over time. It's, you know, there's a significant hardware component to a building energy efficiency, but there's easily as much of a behavioral and operational aspect to maintaining savings once new equipment has been put in place. Sustainable Buildings 2030 was a guideline that was put in place in 2008. It is designed to reduce carbon output from non-residential buildings and really to make sure that we're striving toward a goal of net zero carbon from new buildings by 2030 compared to 2003 levels. We've had 40 buildings designed to sustainable Building 2030 guidelines so far, and you can see the savings here that are quite significant in those buildings. This program has been one that we've cooperated very closely with the architect and engineer community, as well as the University of Minnesota. We think, particularly as the economy improves and new buildings are being constructed at a faster pace, that this program will have greater and greater impact over time. Let's see. I think we have already covered D3 benchmarking, so I won't belabor that slide any longer. And I know I'm probably running out of the time you allotted for me. These are just some of the statistics of buildings that are involved in the B3 program. This one by sector: public schools, state, higher ed, and you can see the rest. And the other by square footage, by sector, and you can see that public schools really are where the largest number of square footage is kind of kept at the public sector level in this state, actually by a considerable margin, and that's been a focus of ours to make sure that public schools are going through the B3 program so that they can manage their energy use better. I mentioned before the Better Buildings Challenge, and this was an Obama administration initiative that Minnesota and a number of other states and private companies have signed on to. And in the case of state participants, the commitment on the part of the state is to reduce energy consumption in public buildings 20% by 2020. And on our side, the responsibility is to track energy use in those state-owned buildings, showcase the projects that are going through our guaranteed energy savings program. And really it is through our guaranteed energy savings program, our performance contracting program, that Minnesota is complying with the Better Buildings Challenge. Turn just toward the end now, and be wrapping up in just a moment, Madam Chair, with some of the efforts that we're involved in on the financing of energy efficiency. I just mentioned the Guaranteed Energy Savings Program. This came about as a result of an early executive order from Governor Dayton in 2011 to establish a Guaranteed Energy Savings Program. Actually, we had such a program on the books, but it wasn't being very actively used. We took steps to pre-qualify 11 energy services companies under a master contract to be the providers of the program. All state agencies and local units of government are eligible to participate, and the Department of Commerce provides technical support to those state agencies and local units of government at their request. So far with the program, we've developed 5 interagency agreements, 5 joint powers agreements, and a number of projects in the development pipeline at 9 sites, about 171 buildings, over 7 million square feet of space, about a $42 million estimated investment in those buildings, with over 600 new jobs created as a result of that work, mostly in the construction industry. This committee has probably heard something about property assessed clean energy, and this is a program by which those who are interested in communities that have PACE set up are allowed then to finance those programs through installment payments on their property tax assessments. What's involved is the local government establishes a PACE program. The building owner completes an audit to determine whether there is a feasible energy savings initiative that's available at that building. The administrator at the local level approves, and the city makes the assessments to the property owner. Then the property owner, of course, completes the improvements, and then that owner is able to use the savings generated from the investment to pay off the monthly assessments or the however often they're being assessed on their property taxes. There are several PACE programs that have already gotten started, most notably a program in Edina, but there are a number of other cities across the state and one of our regional development commissions that are looking very actively at initiating PACE programs in their communities, again, as a way to facilitate energy savings investments on the part of residents in those communities. Another effort that has certainly helped with financing, in this case, for commercial and industrial projects, is the Trillion BTU program administered by the St. Paul Port Authority. It's a revolving loan fund. It has used and recycled money that the state received under the Stimulus Act to reduce energy consumption throughout the Xcel service territory, and we're looking at whether it's possible to expand the program statewide. Been a number of accomplishments here, as you can see. Investments already of over $17 million, lots of energy savings and jobs created. And importantly, that there have been no defaults on any of the loans to date. So we've been able to buy down the interest rate on this program significantly so that they're below market rate loans, and it's been a very popular program. So with that, Madam Chair, I'm certainly available for any questions committee members might have.
Thank you, members. He went 10 minutes over his allocated time. That's all right. But if we have a brief question. Okay. Representative Guinness.
Thank you. Brief question that maybe we can get some information later. But I was looking at your weatherization assistance program and missing some context here. So you're talking about nearly 20,000 homes. What's the population that out of what is my question, and you can do that later. But then I look at the rest of our homes, and when they're built before a certain date, they're pretty obsolete for energy. So what is the size of the energy efficiency problem that we have? And if you could help us with that at a later date, I think that would be really helpful.
Madam Chair, Representative Guinness would be happy to do that, and I don't have all those statistics on the top of my head, so we'd be happy to get back to the committee with that information.
Thank you.
Great question. Senator Senjum.
And thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm looking at this slide here, and maybe I'm in some way asking the same question. I'm not sure, but where it talks about energy savings for 210 and 211.
Yep.
Does the department have any actual data relative to Minnesota megawatts of electricity less that are used? You know, is that graphed anywhere, or natural gas or anything like that? Is there just any kind of consumption graphs that you can share with us at some point, maybe in the future?
Senator Senjum, you've just done the best segue possible for our next speaker.
Okay.
Yeah. The guy who actually counts the megawatts is our next speaker.
It wasn't intended.
So. Yeah, we certainly do have that information and get that to you.
So thank you, and I'm sure, Senator Dibble. I'm sure other members will approach you later, but Senator Dibble.
This is just really technical information that maybe we can get later. I'm curious about the PACE program. Was it in southwestern Minnesota, the RDC down there, and just the 18 county region? I'm just curious how they establish that with the property tax assessment mechanism.
But sure, we can get back to you on that. Yep.
Thank you so much. Sorry we've given you such a brief period of time to testify tonight. And our next testifier is Mike Miser from Energy Platforms LLC, and he literally runs the program that counts the energy savings. So please introduce yourself and go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members of the Commission, for this opportunity to speak with you this evening. I had the chance this summer to meet with several of you to tell you about some work that's been going on for the last couple of years between our company, Energy Platforms, and DER, to try and help our utilities in the state take our utility-based energy efficiency effort to the next level. And in those meetings that I had, almost every one of you that I had the opportunity to meet with this summer said, hey, my colleagues need to hear about this. Could you come have a short presentation to tell them what you've been doing over the last couple of years? So I appreciate that opportunity. My presentation will be short here this evening. It's just a handful of slides. And what I'd like to cover, I'd like to give you a little bit of background. I want to tell you who our company is. I want to tell you a little bit about what we've done, what the product is that we're trying to move forward to help the state move forward. I'll tell you about some of the results data that we've achieved within the state of Minnesota, and that's about it. And I'm going to show you probably a couple of snapshots of some of the software that we've developed, but I'm not going to go too deep. I'll keep this at a very high level. So energy platforms, we are a software company. We are data folks. We're focused exclusively on the energy efficiency domain. We are a small and growing company located in Shakopee, Minnesota today. And we really got our start to help the state of Minnesota implement the Next Generation Energy Act of 2007. And I think it's important for me to share with the reason why. The Next Generation Energy Act effectively mandated the munis and co-ops to start running energy efficiency programs. And you can say, well, why did the legislature mandate the munis and co-ops? Well, they effectively represented about half of the energy savings in the state of Minnesota. The big issue there is that we have over 170 munis and co-ops. Created some very significant challenges to gather data and collect it and to understand what's happening. But also many of these utilities are very small and didn't have the IT and engineering resources to actually implement programs and report back. So that's really why we got our start. The product that we developed is called ESP. It stands for Energy Savings Platform. And it is a state-of-the-art IT platform located in the cloud. And it's really doing two key functions for our state and our utilities. Number one, we're providing tools to help the utilities implement their energy efficiency programs and report back. And then number two, because these are constituent dollars, we have a responsibility for the accountability and transparency on these programs to understand what's happening, and we provide that through our reporting tools. Overall, I think what ESP does is it simplifies SIP for most of the utilities in Minnesota. It leverages the IT and the engineering that we have across the utilities and across the state, and it provides a common set of data to help all of our utilities and the stakeholders in the state move EE forward. I might even argue that it's going to help Minnesota achieve its SIP goals, and without a doubt, I'd argue at probably the lowest possible cost. So some of our results data since the implementation of the Next Generation Energy Act, and we're up to about a $200 million spend a year, but through this period of time, we've spent a little over $700 million on utility-based EE programs. We've saved over 53,000 gigawatt hours. And I know that sounds a lot, and I've been asked by some of your colleagues here that we need to translate that into a better understanding for the layperson. But really, the one item that I wanted to focus on as a data guy, when I looked at this, as we've been putting some of the metrics and dashboards in, we have a thing that we call lifetime of the measure. And for those of you who might be new to EE, a measure is something that we do to a building to save energy. For example, if we replace these light bulbs with a more efficient fixture, that's what we call a measure. Most of the policy, or much of our policy on the Next Generation Energy Act, is focused on first-year savings. So meaning that whether I'm installing a light bulb that might last for 3 years or a motor that might last for 10 years, we're focused on what the first-year savings are. From an effectiveness perspective, sometimes the cost effectiveness of those measures that have a much longer lifetime is dramatically different. And so I think it's important for us to reflect on the utilities, of course. They're managing what they can measure and what they need to report on. So the impact of the policy is changing the way the utilities are operating their programs. The other aspect that I really wanted to focus on, I thought at a real high level, we look at, and there's all sorts of ways to look at cost effectiveness of energy efficiency. But during this period of time from 2008 to 2012, the average retail price that your constituents were paying are between 8 and 9 cents a kilowatt hour. The average cost of energy efficiency on the lifetime of the measure is about 1.5 cents per kilowatt hour. We're saving a ton of money, almost $3.5 billion, based on the lifetime of those measures that have been installed since 2008. It's a phenomenal return, and I think to me this is probably why this was a wonderful bipartisan effort, that we are saving constituents a ton of money. So I have a couple of shots. Annie asked if I might just give you a couple of shots. I'm not going into any detail. One of the things that we do on the reporting platform is we provide some top-level dashboards to help us understand what was spent, what are the energy savings per year as this gets aggregated from all of our utilities. It really helps us understand how we're doing with respect to our goals on both electric and gas. There's a couple of ways, once you have this kind of capability, you can cut through the data. One of the things that we can do is cut through the data to find out which programs are cost-effective and which ones maybe aren't as cost-effective. It's phenomenally valuable to the utilities to help them. Maybe if they're running a portfolio of programs and they're not as cost-effective in one area as the rest of the state, they could call up some of the other utilities and say, hey, what are you doing there? I see you're really running some cost-effective programs. Maybe there's something I can learn from you to tune up what I'm doing. It's wonderful also from a policy perspective. So we've been talking about we're going to have updates in building codes. We have technologies that are changing and are probably working through their cost curve. We have an opportunity to understand what those impacts are, you know, with real data. And it can help us then tune up what our policy is. So we think it's really wonderful from that perspective. We also, you can cut through the data by the types of utilities or on the utilities to find out what were the total savings, how cost effective were they. So just some wonderful ways to help us understand the effectiveness of our policy. And so I think really finally, in summary, I have to tell you from a data guy's perspective, just looking at this, our results since 2008 have been nothing short of phenomenal. I think very impressive results. There could be an opportunity to tune up some of the policy. ESP, of course, leveraging technology to help us achieve this at the lowest possible cost. And then finally, I really have to say there's some good work done by our legislature, DER. I got to give credit to Bill Grant, Janet Streff, Jessica Burdett, and Joe Plummer that really had faith for us in developing these tools to help us take the next level. But then, of course, we've got to thank our utilities who are really doing the heavy lifting in this effort. So with that stated, I'm pretty excited. I think we're getting started, really, in EE with these tools, and I'm excited by the future. So thank you for that opportunity.
Thank you for your testimony. Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Two questions. First question, given your success of leveraging technology, have you considered contacting MNsure to help them there with their website? Or? No, I'm just kidding. It's not a real question. The second question is just based off the Winfield
timely.
Hearing. Yeah. Is it
go ahead.
Too soon?
No.
Okay, all right.
Timely. Go ahead with your second question.
There's salt on the roads and salt in the roads and salt in the wound.
No, just having some fun. In terms of what your data and your metrics show, what are the three most efficient forms of energy efficient programs that we're using in our state right now? Or just there's a couple of them.
Just standalone, the biggest thing that stands out is lighting. You know, lighting programs have been very cost-effective and saving a ton of money, probably the single biggest thing. And we know that, you know, there are some changes in the standards that can affect some of that cost-effectiveness. Mm-hmm. But then on the other hand, we have some amazing new technologies that are coming down in their price curve that could provide some other significant opportunities long-term as well. LEDs is what I'm referring to, of course.
Senator Osmek.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Couple questions. One, how do you filter out in your savings, your identification of savings, how do you filter out organic activity? Example being, you used the example of lights. Programs are to initiate, make behavior move. In some cases, switching a light bulb out is because it was burnt out and you went to the store and got a new light bulb and it is more efficient. When you're talking about how you're calculating savings, how do you build that? Do you build that into your calculations that organic activity would normally take place on its own without any activity? Or do you build that into that into your models?
Mr. Meiser.
Wonderful question. And actually, the results data that we have currently that I presented here this evening was primarily for many of the utilities as reported. We didn't have the transparency into some of the calculations and how they were done. But the management tools that we've put in place, we're actually providing them the calculators with the appropriate and acceptable deemed inputs that are feeding these calculations, so we're getting at just that. So we're going to have actually far more reliable data going forward, which is part of why I get excited as a data guy to think now we're having these phenomenal calculators where we're going to know exactly what's happened, how those savings were calculated, what are the inputs, so we're going to have that. And we can tune those up each year. The staff at DER does tune those, some of the inputs into those formulas. They tune them up each year when they get some better feedback about what the appropriate changes might be to some of those inputs, sort of addressing exactly what you're talking about. So we can really rely on this data.
Thank you. Senator Marty?
Madam Chair, Mr. Meiser, you had mentioned that that one of the benefits of this is when utilities find out what some of the best effective things are, they can learn from each other. Do you, in your context with like the smaller ones, co-ops and munis, do you hear from them, hey, we heard this and we've been in touch with each other? Do you know that that's happening, or you just suspect it is? Or
yeah, great Mr. question, Meiser. Too. And actually, let me share with you a comment I heard from one of the utilities. So typically, and all over this country, utilities are reporting in PDF documents or Excel spreadsheets, and that's where their results are going. In Minnesota, and as far as I know, and I operate nationally, we are the first state that has a complete set of data from all our utilities. We actually, before we rolled out the reporting tool a couple of years ago, we thought we might get pushback from the utilities because then we're sort of shining a flashlight, right, providing some of that transparency. But actually, the feedback was the exact opposite, and I'm going to quote you one of what the utilities said. They said, you know, I've always wondered how I was doing compared to my colleagues. And really, what I see is these utilities doing very good work out there. They care deeply about this work, and they want to know how well they're doing compared to others. So I've heard from others that they are using this. I don't know how much they're actually calling up. I can't answer that. But I know they're using the data. And it was wonderful to hear, actually, from them that this is useful.
Last question, Representative Wiginius.
Yes, thank you. Representative Garofalo asked you, what were the top three things that were savings, and but lights is the top one of the number one. But I'm going to ask the question a different way. When I look at the weatherization program, how does that stack up for savings? Can you tease that out?
Representative, I can't answer it because the weatherization program is not included. These are the utility-based energy efficiency programs. We have actually talked to DER about broadening the data that we get, for some example, the opt-outs, to have them actually report into ESP and to maybe use some of these other sources. But today we don't do that, but I think it's a great idea for us to understand and capture that and evaluate some of these other efforts too.
Representative McGinnis.
It would be important.
Yeah, it would be to see it side by side with the dollar saved and the energy saved.
Yeah, you can't, absolutely, unless you can, it's apples and oranges right now. So it's a good one. I know some of my colleagues from DER are here, and I'm sure we'll queue this up. We'll see what we can do to address that.
Thank you very much for your presentation tonight.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Senjum.
And Madam Chair, going back to my last question, Mr. Meiser, on your page 3, I just want to make sure I'm interpreting this correctly. And let's just use, for instance, electrical saving on that line 4. And just follow with me. In 2008, it suggests we had savings of 571 million kilowatt hours. And then 620 in 2009. And is that... Are those numbers building on the previous year each time?
No, these that are currently captured in here, as the policy requests, those are the first year savings. I pull out the lifetime savings from deeper in that's not visible here, but those are the first year savings.
Senator Dibble.
Is that?
So, thanks, ma'am. Just to be clear, so.
Yeah, I'm not clear, but.
Yeah. So in 2008, we say 571 million kilowatt hours, and then in year 2009, do we save an additional $620 million?
Ah, okay. So,
and that was my question, yeah.
Thank you. Thanks for that clarification. So the way the utilities are reporting in ESP is for the Next Generation Energy Act. They are to report first-year savings from the measures that were applied that year. So each year, those are the first-year savings from the measures that were applied that year.
Mr. Meiser, so it's not cumulative.
Correct.
So in order to get a cumulative total, and it only counts first-year savings, you'd have to add those all together. And, you know, that's one of the discussion points I had with the munis and the co-ops who were having a little bit of a hard time reaching their SIP goals, is that when you only get credit for what happens in the first year, they feel like we're undercounting what they're doing. And so that's a topic we'll have more conversation about whether we're measuring it in the right way. And we don't want to incent things that only give you a big savings in the first year, but then fall off in value over the years. We want to incent things that are as valuable through their life as they are in the first year. So it highlights a policy point that we need to look at. Thank you very much. We were going to try really hard to stay on our schedule, and we've fallen 7 minutes behind. But we are moving on to Jenny Edwards from CEE for our next presentation. Thank you for being here tonight.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. And I have my timer right here, so I will be watching my time and go quickly. Very much appreciate the opportunity to come and speak with you about these issues and your engagement on them as well. So I'm Jenny Edwards. I'm a program manager at the Center for Energy and Environment. We're a nonprofit based in Minneapolis, Minnesota, proud to be entering our 35th year working on energy and environmental issues in the state. Our nonprofit mission is to advance the public interest in cleaner energy and a healthier economy, and we do that by conducting technical research on efficiency opportunities, by being program implementers for several utilities across the state. We do project financing, especially for residents and small commercial businesses, to assist them with their efficiency projects. And we work on policy innovation to help leaders on energy efficiency in the state come up with the next generation of solutions. They don't let me out of the office too often. I like to sit there and analyze things. So in leading from the previous presentation, certainly that data helps me with my job. My colleagues Brian Halloran and Mike Bowler are also here, and they're more likely to be the faces that you see here on the Capitol, but I'm happy to be here with you. So I'm going to talk more broadly about how energy efficiency can be considered a system resource. And I have up here a picture of wires and transmission lines and power plants and all of the infrastructure that we think of as serving our energy needs. And I want to put energy efficiency within that same framework for you so that it's seen as a resource serving our energy needs, but by reducing demand instead of necessarily increasing supply. Energy efficiency, especially from the customer perspective, sometimes suffers by having visible costs but less visible savings. And this is especially true for ratepayers who don't necessarily participate directly in efficiency programs. So those costs of efficiency are often very more obvious. They're tracked on an annual basis. The total dollar amount of spending is seen, and that's recovered on bills by ratepayers. Sometimes this is sort of visualized as money being put into a pot that needs to equal the money being taken out of the pot, if you think of that draw being the rebates that customers get to benefit them doing their programs. And what that misses is that there's less visible system-wide savings going on behind the scenes that aren't being accounted for in the same way that we account the program costs. And so I'm going to talk a little bit about how you might go about quantifying some of those benefits to actually get an apples-to-apples sense of what those what that program spending is bringing. So one of the main reasons that energy efficiency reduces costs, as has been described by the previous two presentations, is that it reduces the need for power plants. So as you save energy year after year, and this slide goes to that discussion about incremental versus cumulative savings that we were just having, but you have annual megawatt savings accrued by programs every year. This example is the case of Xcel Energy, Northern States Power's programs starting back in 1992, which are the largest ones that the state has. And as those annual savings stack up year after year, you get a much larger cumulative savings that in many cases amounts to several power plants that you can offset over longer time periods. So, for example, this program is saved somewhere between 7 and 10 power plants, depending on what you assume about those numbers. We wanted to compare the cost of what we're calling the resource wedge. So looking at that case study of the demand-side management, DSM or SIP programs, you can think of the energy that those programs saved as essentially this highlighted wedge that you could meet by either conducting energy efficiency programs or potentially by building power plants. And those two options will have very different costs associated with them. And I'll actually show you an example where we calculated what those costs would be and looked at how you might recover them through rates by defining those costs as the sum of the additional dollars divided by the total energy sales that you would be able to recover the costs over. What those numbers look like when you compare efficiency to power plants, again, this is over previous 20 years of this one program case study, is that on the efficiency side, the costs are about a quarter of a cent per kilowatt hour, and on the power plant side, it's about two-thirds. So you see that what you've spent in efficiency, you've actually saved almost three times over in what you avoided building in order to supply that resource wedge. And two important things to note. One is that, of course, the cost of the resource plays in here. So how much does it cost to go out and procure a kilowatt hour of efficiency versus a kilowatt hour from a power plant? And efficiency is lower in that case. But you also have fewer sales that you can recover those costs over, and that's an important other factor that's being considered here. So you have fewer kilowatt hours over which to recover those costs in the efficiency case. Another important note about this sort of apples-to-apples comparison between efficiency and power plants is that, especially for investor-owned utilities, you need to put it in the wider business context. And so we looked at that as well, which is that those system-wide costs and what it requires for a utility to go procure this resource also has to include the incentives that they require to do so. And on the power plant side, that's by accruing shareholder returns from the investment that they make. And on the efficiency side, that's by having performance incentives available to the utility when they meet or exceed those goals. And we include those costs in our analysis as well. As you can see, the total costs on the efficiency side from this case study that we looked at are, again, about a third as much as they would be on the power plant side. And this slide just notes how those costs are broken up. So you can see on the efficiency side, it does include incentives. On the power plant side, it's the capital costs from building that, and it's also largely the fuel. In this case, we're assuming we assume natural gas power plants. Of course, we looked backwards. So we looked back over the past 20 years and did a hypothetical, you know, what if? What else would have happened? We don't know what that past looks like any more than we necessarily know what the future looks like. So we also wanted to do some sensitivities on this and say, well, what if instead of gas power plants, what if a coal plant had been avoided? What if a much greater transmission line investment had been avoided? And this slide just shows that, without reading into the details too much, that all of those cases on the power plant side resulted in costs that were, you know, essentially two to three and a half times higher than the efficiency resource. So in summary, this is an interesting way of looking at the costs of efficiency and making sure that you're also taking into account the costs that didn't accrue. The power plant costs in that we looked at are three to four times higher than those efficiency program costs, even when you have more sales that you can recover those costs over. It's important to note that this includes all efficiency costs because those are recovered year after year, but power plant costs, it only includes 20 years, and we still have debt out on those power plants because that's usually recovered over 30 to 40-year time horizon. And this is looking backwards at what could have happened. It's obviously very important to note that going forward, the conditions would likely be different on both sides of the ledger. The 20 years of efficiency that's happened in the previous 20 years will not be the same as the next 20 years of efficiency. And the costs of power plants have also changed. So they're more expensive to build now. Fuel is also much cheaper. So there's much to be cautioned in terms of taking this and applying it going forward, but it's certainly interesting perspective for programs that are just starting and as a method for thinking about those benefits as well as the costs. So thank you very much.
Questions for members?
Very clear and straightforward presentation. Yeah. Thank you. Next, we're going to move to Excel. And I hope that folks don't mind if members contact you later if we think of questions for the presenters who maybe didn't get asked questions here. You might get an email from somebody later because I have a feeling I'm giving the sense that we want to keep moving, which is accurate. Welcome to the committee. Please state your names for the record.
Madam Chair, I'm Rick Evans with Xcel Energy, and I'm just here to observe, but answer any questions that may come my way. Jessica Peterson from Xcel will be doing our presentation.
Good evening, Madam Chair, members of the Commission. I'm Jesse Peterson. One of the things I do at Xcel Energy is focus on SIP policy and strategy for our future. And so thank you for having me come today. I look forward to talking a little bit about what we're seeing on our side. Xcel Energy has a significant track record of not only performance in SIP, but also supporting SIP as well. We've been involved in this since the beginning in the early 1990s, a little bit before that as well. There's a lot of reasons that we do that, one being that conservation saves customers money, it provides customer choice, it benefits the environment, and it supports our communities, all of which are very important. At Xcel, we have nearly 20 business programs, 19 residential programs, and anything in between. We help customers with rebates, studies, and education, all of which help us towards our goals. For the past 2 years, Xcel Energy has exceeded the energy savings targets. In 2012 alone, we avoided 143 megawatts of capacity. In the past 10 years, participants have saved nearly $2 billion over the past 10. What's important to note on here is also where some of that savings is actually coming from. 80% of our, or approximately 80% or so of the residential savings comes from lighting. We talked a lot about lighting in some of the other presentations. It's important to note that it's a significantly large portion of our portfolio. I want to talk a little bit about some of the changes that are occurring out in the marketplace, how it's changing the dynamics of SIP, and challenging us as we move forward in our goals. Historical performance isn't necessarily going to let us know what our future holds. Three things that I do want to talk to you about, and I'll make it brief this evening. One is that federal standards are increasing. What that does is lower the energy potential that we can claim, and I'll explain that in a minute. We also know that our budgets are increasing, and they may be increasing at a larger rate than what our savings claimed are. We also have declining use by customer. This is a great thing for Minnesota, but it is impacting how we run our programs. I want to talk a little bit about changing standards. As many of you know, the federal standards are changing at a fast rate. That's a good thing. The biggest one being lighting. Now, as standards are raised, what we can claim from our baseline changes. I'll give you a little bit of an example of that. We used to be able to look at an incandescent bulb, which soon you won't be able to see anymore. And that incandescent bulb, say, was 60 watts. If you look at a CFL bulb, that was 15 watts. So the difference is about 45 watts or so. That is what we could claim. That's changing. In the future, we'll only be able to claim from a halogen light to a CFL. So that's about a 20% change. So right off the top, the savings we claim for our energy savings goals has been lowered. I want to talk a little bit about rising costs and declining use as well. Not only is that savings becoming lower, the cost to get those savings is increasing. SIP budgets nationally have increased. That's kind of a fact. We can see that across the nation. I read something, I believe yesterday, that said the United States alone is spending $83.3 billion on energy conservation. That's a good thing. However, there's some cost drivers here in Minnesota that we're a little bit concerned about on our end. The latest technologies are obviously more expensive. If you walk into Home Depot, you can see one sign that says $3 for a CFL, and another sign that would tell you that it's LED, it's possibly $15. Significant difference. We actually spend about 60% of incremental cost towards our rebates. On a CFL at $3, that's $1.80. On a CFL, or on an LED, rather, that would be about $9. So there's some impact there. The cost is more expensive for less savings. On top of that, those people over on that side of the room may not be interested in LED at all. And so we have to spend more money promoting the conservation efforts and trying to convince people that that's the best way to go. So not only are we spending more money on incentives, but also on promotions and trying to reach the harder-to-reach customers. Usage per customer is also dropping, which of course is a great thing for Minnesota. We should congratulate ourselves. But we base our past successes and how we base our cost effectiveness tests is around the next usage of generation, kind of like what Jenny had just told us. And that's a good thing. But if that changes, it changes how we look at our cost effectiveness. We know that in the past, from our triennial filing for 2013 through 2015, we know that that cost effectiveness has changed a little bit. And we expect that it's going to change a little bit more as we continue, and as usage changes, and as how we use energy changes as well. There's a lot of things that CLNG we're doing to try to overcome these challenges and look at how we want to do things in the future. In our current filing, we've already looked at adjusting standards, or adjusting the baselines that we use for those standards. We've adjusted some of the cost effectiveness and noted how they're moving so that we can keep an eye on them moving forward. And we've also started looking at programs that kind of go outside the box from just switching out your light bulbs or switching out your air conditioners at home. We're looking at more things that are holistic, looking at whole buildings, whole homes, and trying to find things from a higher level so you can bring all those things together for hopefully higher energy savings. We're also going to fully explore some of these issues and challenges as we move forward with our IRP, which should be filed in July of 2014. Thank you.
I have a question, and this might be for you, Mr. Evans. I think in the last rate case that Excel filed, was there a proposal related to decoupling and getting at the issue of separating? And I didn't mean to spring this on you. I didn't think this question was going to occur to me, or I would have given you a heads up. But does the increased difficulty that you project in SIP programs in the future have anything to do with the proposal that came forward in the last rate filing on that topic?
I don't know the answer to that question.
Okay.
You're right. We have a decoupling proposal for residential customers that is proposed in our rate case. It's a different way to approach the economics of conservation for utility companies. I don't know whether that was done in response to some of the problems or the challenges that Jesse's identifying, or if that was because of a lot of conversations that have been going on for a long time about decoupling programs.
And I kind of asked that question as kind of a prelude, too, because I think we're going to be having more conversations as we move forward on the issue of decoupling and where utilities see it going and how it might be helpful in this particular area. Other questions from members?
I do have more information on the decoupling and why that is that we can provide.
Thank you. Representative Falk.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm trying to – I believe – in one of the more recent requests before the PUC that Excel brought, there was a request to basically be able to recover more because you were selling, or the company was selling, less power. Was that part, I'm trying to remember, if was that correct?
Well,
Mr. Evans.
Madam Chair, Representative Falk, just in the general way that a rate case works, if we add up all of our costs and we divide it by our projected kilowatt hours that our customers are going to buy, you divide money by kilowatt hours, you get a rate. So if that denominator is shrinking because of less use by our customers, projected less use, then in fact your rate's going to be higher depending on what happens in the numerator. So just in the general way a rate case functions, as usage goes down, a rate of dollars per kilowatt hour is going to go up.
Right, and I...
Representative Falk.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I know that wholesale power prices have fallen significantly since, like, pre-recession. And oftentimes it's attributable to the fact that we see low natural gas price. But if we're ultimately using less kilowatt hours and your math equation holds true, it's got to be that the efficiency is actually helping to have a larger impact than perhaps we think it is. The cumulative effect, because we're taking some of the demand peaks out, would that be something that you'd
Madam Chair, Representative Falk, well, the thing to keep in mind is that that fuel costs are not included in the rate calculation in a rate case. Fuel costs are passed through in the fuel clause, which is you know, varies with the price of fuel. So, you know, the amount of the price of fuel is going to go down, or, you know, the amount you're going to pay for fuel is going to go down. That's not really it doesn't change the numerator of the equation, if you will. What's going to change the numerator of the equation, you know, and has historically, is, you know, the fact that we're not building those power plants that were shown in the graph. Those kind of capital expenditures and O&M costs of operating power plants would have shown up in the numerator and would have increased costs. So you do see the cost. I mean, if the formula works, you know, which I believe it does, then you do see those savings, or the savings are occurring. You may not see them because, you know, the cost of not building a power plant doesn't really show up anywhere. You just haven't built it.
Madam Chair,
Representative Falk.
Thank you, Mr. Evans. I think we're thinking on the same page here. I understand that fuel costs aren't in the rate cases, but they'll reflect it through wholesale power rates, and ultimately it all gets reflected back to a person's bill. But I think we're thinking that we're on the same page too, that oftentimes I think it's alluded to that these efficiency programs, they really don't attribute to much in the way of savings, but we've seen, because we have recovered a significant amount of economic output to pre-recession levels, the lower cost of energy cannot be simply attributable to the low-cost fuel. It's because we've also taken some of the demands out and some of the peaks out, and the efficiency programs are having a cumulative effect that's ultimately bringing rates down across the board. That's at least what I've interpreted. I think perhaps that's what you've trying to say and you've seen as a result of
it. I think we would agree with that.
Thank you.
It's a good night. We've got Representative Falk and Rick Evans on the same page. So it's time to move on to our next presentation. We have Minnesota Chamber of Commerce and their nonprofit arm, WasteWise, is here to tell us a little bit about Energy Smart. And my understanding is that Ben Gerber is here for difficult political questions that Representative Garofalo might want to throw out.
Yeah. Madam Chair, was anyone else in the committee when you were looking at the presentation for noticing the 24 cents a kilowatt hour cost of efficiency programs and wondering why that was so high?
I think that's a portion of a...
Okay, well, you figured it out. I did. Okay. So I just went back and asked the question, was learned that's actually a quarter of a cent.
Right.
So
I think she said that when she did the presentation. Otherwise, I think I wouldn't have known that. Sorry about that.
What the hell are they spending the money on?
Welcome to... Yeah, and you were about to start making comparisons to other technologies that I like, right?
Actually, Madam Chair, just to point out, I actually already did the calculations. And if you view solar as a demand-side management, right, solar is 162 times more expensive than those programs.
Right.
So
I knew you had done the math, so thank you, Representative Garofalo. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and go ahead.
My name is Jill Curran. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm here in two capacities, one with the Minnesota WasteWise Foundation and the other with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, here to tell you about the Energy Smart program. I kind of just sitting here listening to y'all talk about everything tonight. It's, I think the best way to explain what we do is we're behind the scenes where the implementation never really hits the road. We assist businesses, specifically small and medium-sized businesses that wouldn't have a utility representative calling on them, the kind of businesses that have to figure this out for themselves. We're here to help them. One thing we do is we try very, very hard to produce good results for the dollars that we're given to do the job we do, and we're told that we're pretty good at it by both our sponsors, our funders, and the businesses that we work with. We offer value-add services. So, again, businesses, specifically small and medium-sized businesses, don't have a lot of time to talk about this stuff, but we know it's good for them, and we want to make sure we give them a good value for their time. We're also pretty well connected. We've been here for about 5 years doing what we do. We know the business community really well because of our relationship with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. We're able to leverage their connection to the business community. We partner closely with State Energy Office. They actually prove what we do, the funds to do what we do. And we're well connected to many of the utilities throughout the state, too. What I can tell you is that last year we facilitated 67 upgrades through primarily in the Xcel Energy service area, but in a few other utility service areas as well. These upgrades resulted in $2,114,000 of kilowatt-hour savings. And also resulted in estimated energy cost savings of $179,610. This equated to about $2,680 per business. And again, these are really small businesses that we work with. That's a lot of money to them each year, a lot of money. Just to back up a little bit, tell you a little bit more about Energy Smart. We were created in 2008 as an indirect SIP program run by the Minnesota Wastewise Foundation, which is a 501c3 nonprofit affiliate of the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. The Minnesota Wastewise Foundation was created in 1994, so we're almost 20 years old. And in October 2013, the foundation board decided to have the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce have the Energy Smart and the Wastewise programs be part of the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. One really important thing that I want to note is that I have two roles. We're the same staff doing the exact same thing that we've been doing for 5 years on the Energy Smart side and 20 years on the Wastewise side. As I mentioned, we're funded through state-approved utility conservation programs. Our services are at no cost for organizations located within our funding utility service areas. Our purpose is to help energy utilities achieve their state-mandated Next Generation Energy Act goals. And on the chamber side of our operation, we're trying really hard to help businesses reduce their operational costs through energy efficiency savings. We leverage our connection, to, as I said, to the chamber to engage the business community. And we've worked primarily in the Xcel Energy, Minnesota Power, Otter Tail Power, Interstate Power and Light, Conexus Energy, Hibbing, Ely, North St. Paul, and Ely on there twice, municipal service areas. We focus our efforts primarily on outreach. We try really, really hard to reach as many new businesses as we can every single year. Since the program was launched in 2009, we've contacted over 12,000 businesses. And these are first-hand contacts, usually two or three attempts to get them engaged. And again, in the same time frame, we visited over 1,200 businesses and facilitated about 292 upgrades, which is a conversion of about 24% of the businesses that we actually visit. Again, we provide value-add services. The core of our services are on-site energy consultations. Many of the utilities have utility representatives visiting their customers, and they usually focus on the larger customers, and the small and medium-sized businesses are left on their own. So that's really the core of the businesses that we try to help. Another key thing that we do is project implementation assistance. Again, many of these businesses don't know anything about conservation improvement program dollars and opportunities for saving energy, and we try really hard to make sure that they understand their opportunities and what their savings potential may be. And then we've realized quickly that they need a little help crunching the numbers, so we help them do that too. Wanted to give you a couple of examples of some businesses that we've worked with. I just brought two examples tonight. Could have brought a lot more, but this example is for the St. Paul Hotel, downtown St. Paul. Now, they have a utility representative that they work with, but because they're a large chamber member, they wanted us to help them a little bit more. We worked very closely with the Xcel Energy account representative, and she pretty much said, keep going, doing what you're doing, keep me informed, and let me know what happens. And this is one lighting project for the St. Paul Hotel that we helped them figure out. They are estimated to save over 140,000 kilowatt hours in the year, and their cost savings are estimated to be $12,191. As I mentioned earlier, we also have something called the WasteWise program. We worked with them on the waste side as well, helped them start an organics diversion program, and they're estimated to save over $25,000 a year in waste hauling costs on that program as well. We're also following several other energy-related projects that they're considering, so those numbers will go up. And then another project that we worked on, this project is with the TPC Twin Cities Golf Club in Blaine. Another lighting project happens to be, and they're estimated to save 78,840 kilowatt hours a year with an estimated cost savings of over $6,000. So these are real numbers for small businesses, and as everybody said here, is you get the year one savings, but they persist over time, so it's money in their pocket. Most of these projects pay back in less than 2 years. That's what I have for you today. Thank you very much for
questions. Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, Ms. Currens, same question I had for Mr. Myers, and that is when you're working with these businesses and they see very positive results, does the Chamber, because the Chamber's got good connections with the businesses, do they see other businesses sharing, hey, you know, your competitor or your friend or your neighboring business down the street is getting this kind of savings, you could too? I'm just curious, when you say you've approached 12,000 businesses, you've had about 1 in 10 of them you've been working with. Are others, I mean, waste-wise, you've been doing that for like 20 years or so.
Yep.
Do more businesses, do you have a lot more involved in that because over time they say, hey, they're saving money, we could do the same? Does it happen that way?
On the energy side, the conversion rate that we have is actually a pretty good conversion rate, believe it or not. 12,000 businesses is a lot of businesses, but it's hard to get them to bite off and do implementation when they're just struggling to keep their door open and they just do not have the money to pay for the upgrades.
Senator Asmik.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Question on how you're determining savings. Are you determining a savings number based upon what the preload was versus what the postload was of the utilization of the particular business? Is that how you're coming up with that determination?
What we do primarily is we take whatever fixture they have, and I'll give you a lighting example. It's straight math. It's 40 watts to 25 watts, whatever the figure might be, and then we calculate it out based on usage, how long is the light on, and then we apply the utility charges, and yeah, so it's straight math.
Okay, Madam Chair, one follow-up.
Senator Asmik.
So when you're doing the replacement of light bulbs, do you take into consideration that many of the light bulbs still were operational and that there is a cost in replacement? Do you factor that into when you're saying that there is savings? Is there an additional – are you factoring in the costs of replacing those bulbs that in many cases may not have actually spent their entire lives? And that level of cost, is that being built into your savings?
Overarching, one thing that I want to point out is we're an indirect program. We rely on the utility rebate format. So in the case of an Xcel Energy rebate form, we plug all the information into that form, and that's our basis. So whatever they have built into their formula is what we use.
Thank you very much for your presentation. Oh, Senator Dibble.
This may be a thank you, Madam Chair.
Might be a Ben Gerber question.
No. Okay. Ben would know what I would ask. I had him at the table. No. and it's not what I mentioned earlier. It's just a simple question, and you might have already said it, and it might be self-evident, but it was discussed earlier that there are operational aspects. It's not just switching out light bulbs, but it's like making sure the doors aren't open in the middle of winter and lights get turned off at night and computers get turned off. Do you do some of that operational consultation as well?
Yes.
Okay.
We look at everything.
Great.
Yep.
Thanks.
Mm-hmm. All right. I don't see any other questions. Thank you very much for your presentation. We appreciate it. Now, our next presenter is Marty Kushler, and he is with us by telephone. Marty, can you hear us?
Yes, I can. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you. And because we're probably not going to be able to hear Marty as well as we've been able to hear people who are in the room, and because he's not here to take visual cues from us, we're going to listen to his presentation. He has 30 minutes, and then we'll do questions for him to the degree we can, and he may be willing to take a couple by email, because I have a feeling doing them audibly is going to be a little bit complicated. So with that, Marty, go ahead. And Annie has your slides. She's getting your slides up, and she will be doing your slides.
Very good. Just let me know as soon as they're visible.
Dr. Koester, can you hear me?
Slides visible?
I think we have a little technical issue, so I'll just click through your slides for you if you want to just use the slide number and let me know when to go ahead.
Okay, so Dr. Koester, I don't know if you could hear Annie, but she, rather than having you go through them, which maybe you were going to do from where you are, she's able to do them, and so if you can refer to the number of the slide, she'll go forward at the rate that you'd like to.
Okay, thank you very much. Good evening, everyone. I really appreciate the invitation to speak with you today on this very important subject. Apologize for the long-distance logistics here. We'll try to make do. I am Martin Kushler. I'm a senior fellow with the American Council for an Energy Efficient Economy. We're a nonprofit organization founded in 1980, headquarters in Washington, D.C., I live and work out of Michigan. Let me say at the outset that Minnesota is one of my favorite states. You've historically done a good job with energy efficiency, so nothing that I'll say is meant as a criticism. But my objective here is to hopefully motivate you to do even better and to suggest some areas where Minnesota could do even more to be a top-tier state. And I should say apologies to those of you who may have seen my testimony before the legislature earlier this year. Some of this will be similar material. I have some new material as well. But I wanted to make sure that your colleagues had an opportunity to see this, and I think the data are important enough that the numbers bear repeating. I will, in the interest of time, be moving through these slides fairly quickly. And I have included in your a couple of appendices in your printed packet that I won't take time to talk about today unless someone has questions at the end. But in the interest of time, those are just some extra slides in your printed packet. So with that, I'll get started. Next slide, please. This is just a slide with some background information about my organization and myself. I won't take time to go over this, except to note that I did spend 10 years on the staff of a utility regulatory commission, so I have a pretty good background on utility issues, and I have over a decade of experience with Minnesota, so I have a pretty good understanding of the situation in your state. And as I said, one of my favorite states. Next slide, please. This should just be a list of topics I'll cover tonight. I won't spend time going over that. Next slide. Let me jump right in with key point number one. Minnesota has a big energy problem. Minnesota uses a lot of energy. The total cost was about $12 billion a year in 2000. That was back before we entered the era of high energy costs. By 2010, that had increased to $21 billion. But more importantly, Minnesota is essentially totally dependent on fuels imported from other states and countries. Minnesota imports 100% of the coal and uranium, 100% of the oil, petroleum, and 100% of the natural gas that you use. Next slide. Let's take a quick look at the economic impact of that energy fuel import dependence. Before the new high energy cost era, about roughly $7 billion a year was leaving Minnesota to pay for fuel imports. At 2010 market prices, this dollar outflow was over $13 billion a year. This is a huge economic drain on the state economy. Next slide. This helps illustrate that economic drain. This is a graph showing the economic burden on Minnesota homes and businesses of all state taxes versus energy costs. bar on the right shows total energy costs about $21 billion. The golden shaded part is dollars leaving the state to pay for imported energy fuels. As you'll notice, that amount is nearly as much as the total state tax burden. But one crucial difference, nearly all of the state tax dollars are spent in the state, whereas all of the energy import dollars leave the state. Next slide. This energy dollar drain has profound effects on the state economy. Just the additional $6 billion drain in current day times versus 2000 in lower energy price times, just that additional $6 billion drain on Minnesota's economy is roughly equivalent to the lost payroll from closing 120 major manufacturing plants. That assumes 1,000 jobs at 50,000 each per plant. Even the Wall Street Journal has written about the unprecedented transfer of wealth, calling it a bonanza and a windfall for the handful of big energy-producing states and countries. Clearly, Minnesota has a big economic problem with the dollar drain for energy fuel imports. Next slide. This leads me to my second key point, and that is that Minnesota's future is not in fossil fuels. Minnesota is blessed with lots of natural resources, but when it comes to fossil fuels, Minnesota got shut out. This slide shows Minnesota's recoverable reserves as a share of U.S. recoverable reserves. Coal, 0%, oil, 0%, natural gas, 0%, and also uranium, 0%. Which naturally leads to the question, why would Minnesota support policies that encourage greater consumption of these resources? Next slide. The next few slides just visually illustrate Minnesota's energy predicament. You'll notice that Minnesota is the only Midwest state with no production or reserves of any of these fuels, which is why I refer to Minnesota's unique disadvantage when it comes to traditional energy sources. This first slide shows coal production by region. As you can see, Minnesota has bupkis, nada. You may also know that Minnesota's dollars flow to Montana and Wyoming to pay for coal imports. Next slide. This slide shows a map of proven oil reserves. Again, nothing for Minnesota, although your neighbor in North Dakota is getting rich, which I'm sure you're all aware of. Next slide. Even the so-called shale gas boom misses Minnesota. Although I guess you are getting to sell some fracking sand, but that doesn't reduce your natural gas import bill. You still have to import all the natural gas that you use. Next slide. So given the harsh reality of the preceding information, it seems like a natural conclusion that as a matter of state policy, Minnesota should be trying to maximize the amount of energy efficiency it can accomplish and minimize the amount of additional fuel imports that it needs. Next slide. That leads me to some good news, which is key point number three. It is much cheaper to save energy than it is to produce it. We can save electricity for about one-third the cost of producing it through a new power plant. Next slide. This is a slide showing the relative cost of new electricity resources based on U.S. national data. I like to use this slide because the data are from Lazard, Inc., which is the largest consulting firm to the international banking industry, not exactly some tree huggers. This is what they tell their business clients about energy costs. As you can see, the midpoint cost for energy efficiency is about 2.5 cents per kilowatt hour. That's the first red bar on the left. This is about a third the cost of the next cheapest options, wind, biomass, and natural gas, and it's about one-fourth the cost of electricity from a new coal plant. And by the way, these costs are without assuming any carbon costs, which if you assume just a $20 per ton cost would add about 2 cents a kilowatt hour to coal electricity and about 1 cent a kilowatt hour to natural gas-fired electricity. Next slide. So given all of the preceding data, one would suggest that Minnesota's electricity policy should be trying to maximize the amount of energy efficiency resources it can acquire and minimize the amount of new power plants needed. And this is, in fact, now the declared policy of a number of leading states. Next slide. In thinking about energy policy options available to states, policy priority number one should be utility sector energy efficiency program. Indeed, substantial utility-funded energy efficiency resource programs are the cornerstone of policy efforts of every leading state on energy efficiency. We see this very clearly in our ACEEE national scorecard rankings of states. I'll show you some data on that in a moment. But there are good reasons for this, including that states typically don't spend tax dollars on this. They tend to be all broke, although I do understand that Minnesota does recently have a surplus, so congratulations on that. I'm sure there are a number of ideas people have for spending and using those funds. But more importantly, utilities are the entities responsible for procuring electricity and natural gas resources, and energy efficiency is a resource they can and should procure. Utilities spend billions of dollars every year, at least $8 billion in Minnesota, and just directing 3 or 4% to energy efficiency would be a very significant resource acquisition. I was going to say a few brief words about energy efficiency as a utility system resource and how that works. I'm going to skip a couple slides because Jenny Edwards did a good job covering that issue. So let's skip forward to a slide titled The Pacific Northwest. Are you able to find that slide?
Yep.
Very good. Thank you. I really like to refer to the Pacific Northwest because they, quite frankly, have the best electric resource planning process in the U.S. And the key point here is that energy efficiency is not some symbolic feel-good gesture. It is indeed a serious utility resource. Pacific Northwest has been at this for 30 years. Since 2005, they've met virtually all of their new electric resource needs through energy efficiency and wind power. The energy efficiency has been achieved at a levelized cost of about 2.4 cents a kilowatt hour. In a second, I'll show you a graph from their resource procurement plan, the citation for which is on the page there. This was issued in 2010. Next slide. So this is a graph of their most recent plan for all new electric resource acquisition that they intend to acquire through 2030. The large green wedge is energy efficiency. The darker blue wedge is RPS wind. The lighter blue or gray wedge is some additional wind beyond the RPS. And the two tiny little slivers that you see in the out years after 2020 are a possible addition of some combined cycle and single cycle gas turbines. But overall, energy efficiency will meet 85% of all their new resource needs, including covering plant retirements during that time period through 2030. Then wind meets nearly all the rest, and then a tiny sliver of some new gas generation. Next slide. So the Pacific Northwest provides a great example of what is possible. Minnesota can chart an energy course that is fundamentally based on energy efficiency and cost-effective local Minnesota renewable resources. This is literally the best thing you can do to address your energy import dollar drain problem. Next slide, please. The last key economic point I wanted to briefly address is that energy efficiency is Minnesota's best opportunity for economic development. Next slide. I like to refer to energy efficiency as the economic triple play. Energy efficiency is the only resource that boosts the economy and provides jobs in three key ways. First, the direct employment effects of delivering the energy efficiency programs. Of course, any type of new energy project provides that first category. Even digging a hole and filling it up would do that. But only energy efficiency provides both the second and third benefits as well. Second benefit is local respending of the saved energy dollars by energy efficiency participants. When their utility bills go down, they have more money in their pockets and they can spend that. The third benefit is the reduced energy cost for all ratepayers. This is because energy efficiency is the cheapest resource, as we've seen previously, for the utility system. So investing in efficiency keeps utility system costs lower than they would otherwise be. And it also has an effect on market energy prices. Lowering demand reduces the market energy price for power, which benefits, again, all customers, whether they participate in the program or not. By these metrics, energy efficiency is the smartest energy policy a state can pursue. Next slide. So I wanted to briefly take a look at how Minnesota compares to other states on utility sector energy efficiency. Next slide. This is a map showing the 25 states around the country that have established energy efficiency resource standards as of 2012. The percents that you see in the states are usually the annual percent of electricity sales to be saved each year once their policy is fully phased in. Minnesota compares fairly well with their 1.5% annual savings. Not quite as high as the top-tier states, but pretty good. Next slide. This is a table showing the cumulative percent savings that would be reached by 2020 in these various states. Again, Minnesota does fairly well. You can see the highlighted numbers there. Not quite top-tier, but certainly better than a lot of states. Next slide. This should be a map of the 2012 ACEEE Energy Efficiency Scorecard rankings. Every year we rank all 50 states on their energy efficiency policies and achievements. Minnesota, pretty good, comes in at number 9. Next slide. But as I pointed out in my testimony earlier this year, Minnesota sort of plateaued in the rankings in the last 6 years, while several other states in the Midwest have improved quite a bit. The numbers in the states in the Midwest here, the first number is the 2006 ranking, second number is the 2012 ranking. You can see Minnesota was ninth in both of those years. But the shaded states in the Midwest all have shown some pretty good improvement over that time period. Next slide, please. And then ACEEE just recently released its 2013 scorecard, and that trend continued. In fact, Minnesota has fallen out of the top 10 and is now beaten by Illinois and nearly equaled by Iowa and Michigan, a pretty significant change over the last decade in the Midwest. Quite honestly, it's not that Minnesota is really doing worse than anything. It's just that the other states have been working hard to do more. Next slide. So on that note, I'd like to wind up the presentation by providing my overall assessment of Minnesota and then some suggestions for how Minnesota might improve its to become truly top tier in its utility-related energy efficiency policies. For an overall grade, I would say B plus, A minus, pretty good. I am a hard grader, but I do think there are a number of areas where Minnesota could make important improvements. I'll just list them here today. I do provide some additional details on these in the appendix slides. And anyone should feel free to contact me afterwards with questions about any of those. But let me just quickly walk through this list, hit a few highlights. First, I would recommend find ways to save more than the 1.5% per year SIP standard. The very best states in this country are now saving 2% a year or better. It takes a real effort, but that is where the very top tier of states are at. Second, find ways to include deliverable fuels in the SIP program. With Minnesota's 100% import dependence and the high cost of those fuels, it would be nice to be able to incorporate them into SIP somehow. I do have some ideas on that, which I'd be happy to talk about later. Third is improve industrial customer buy-in to the energy efficiency policy. Perhaps the single biggest concern or weakness in Minnesota's current approach is the large customer opt-out problem, and I do have some ideas on that as well. Fourth, find a way to capture combined heat and power as a win-win for all. Combined heat and power is a major area of potential improvement that would really help in Minnesota's rankings as well. I favor establishing a separate standard for CHP since it's not really end-use efficiency, it's not really renewables, it's somewhere in between, and I think it is important enough to deserve its own standard. And there are some important things that would need to be addressed, both for the utilities' perspective and interest on this, as well as customer concerns. But it's important enough to have a good effort. Fifth, improve the regulatory structure for energy efficiency through decoupling. In terms of your regulatory approach for utilities, the one big improvement needed in Minnesota is true symmetrical decoupling for your electric utilities. That would really help, especially when you're talking about efficiency policies to really acquire large amounts of energy efficiency. Sixth, ensure strong participation by public power, munis and co-ops. As you know, munis and co-ops are a big part of Minnesota's electricity system. Need to help them be fully engaged in promoting energy efficiency for Minnesota. They have a big role to play for that. I think the record has been pretty good on SIP, but I think there's some spottiness to that. So I think it's worth taking another look at munis and co-ops, their special circumstances, and how to get them as engaged as fully as possible. Seventh is use hookup fees and rate design to recognize and reward energy efficiency. In particular, one idea I have in the detailed slides is to use a discounted hookup fees and rate design to really advance sustainable buildings 2030, Minnesota's policy for advanced high efficiency new building techniques. There's a real opportunity there. Eighth, formally incorporate utility energy efficiency in state air quality objectives. The U.S. EPA is actively looking for states to include energy efficiency programs in their compliance plans for air emissions regulation. This has real potential for additional economic savings for Minnesota. There's real value to be captured there. Air regulators and utility regulators often don't talk to each other much, so that's a good area for further improvement, I think. I have a little note about greenhouse gases. I'm not making that a priority for advancing energy efficiency because energy efficiency sells itself so well on the economics, but clearly there's room for having a good, strong greenhouse gas policy connected to energy efficiency. And finally, implement utility on-bill energy efficiency loan repayment. Access to financing is one of the key barriers to customer energy efficiency improvements. Low-cost loans with utility on-bill repayment is a rapidly growing strategy that states are adapting. So that'd be a good one to take a look at. Finally, I should say that there are some other areas for improvement, transportation, building codes, and so forth, but those are not my areas of expertise, so I've not offered recommendations in those specific areas. Last slide. So just to wrap up with these conclusions, Minnesota has historically been among the leading states on energy efficiency policy in the top 10. In the last decade, Minnesota has stagnated a little bit while other leading states continue to improve, just fell out of the top 10 in our rankings. Minnesota has more economic reasons to pursue energy efficiency than almost any other state. In particular, recall the energy import dollar drain and the zero fossil fuel resources. Considering climate goals only adds frosting to the cake, and by that I mean every bit of these energy efficiency policy improvements are fully justified by the economics, even if climate was not a concern at all. But if climate is a concern, energy efficiency should surely be the first priority and the cheapest step to take. And finally, there are substantial opportunities for Minnesota to do even better. Just briefly run through those. I have a little more detail in Appendix A. But that concludes the prepared presentation that I had.
Thank you. I'll see if members have questions. We have a very quiet room here for a minute. They look like they're thinking.
I hope they could hear me all right.
Yeah, you came through really well, and the slides are information-rich, so we appreciate them. Any questions from members? I know we're 6 days before Christmas, and so people might have other things that they had preferred to do with their evening tonight. So, Senator Dibble.
Madam Chair, we got to the real meat of the presentation on slide number 30, and I don't want to unpack all of these interesting policy ideas tonight because I want to go home and I haven't had my dinner yet. I hope maybe we can have some opportunity to spend more time with Dr. Kushler to talk about some of these interesting ideas.
Sure, absolutely. Feel free to email, call, whatever. I'd be happy to go into more detail on any of those.
Great, thank you.
Representative Wagenius, can you grab your microphone, hold it real close so Dr. Kushler can hear?
Thank you. I was interested in tying in slide 30 again the air quality objectives, and just wanted this committee to know, or commission to know, that our environment finance, natural resources and ag finance committee is going to hold a January hearing on the costs of the current air quality, the health care costs. It turns out that they're enormous, but we're going to look at both the metro area and Senator Senjum Rochester. It's going to be a joint hearing with our health policy committee. And, of course, I would invite anyone here to join in with us. I think we're all surprised at the healthcare costs that are associated with fine particulate matter. They are enormous.
When I was carrying the clean cars bill, that was a number that we walked around with. I can't remember it now, but it is large, and especially if you look at the children's visits to emergency room and the relationship between things like particulate matter. Mm-hmm. Senator Dibble.
Madam Chair, a question for Representative Wagenius. Yeah. Representative Wagenius, is some of that work that you're doing getting referred also to the Department of Health and their preparation of the health equity report?
I know the Pollution Control Agency, which is developing the numbers, is working with the health department and working with our health providers. Mm-hmm. So we will have health providers at the hearing.
Great.
Well, seeing no further questions tonight, I want to really thank you, Dr. Kushler, for appearing by telephone, and thank you to everybody who's in the room who came out for tonight, and I hope you have a happy and safe holiday with your family, and we'll see you in 2014. This meeting is adjourned.
Merry Christmas, all.
Thank you,
David.
Thank you.